From deported vet to U.S. citizen, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hector Barajas got deported to Mexico after serving in the U.S. Army. He spent years fighting to get U.S. citizenship. Now that he's got it, he wants other deported vets to know he'll keep fighting for them.
Just because I got my citizenship doesn't mean that's it. You know, see you guys.
Also, as tensions rise between Israel and Iran, this Tehran resident tells us she's worried.
It seems that both sides are longing for war. I don't understand why.
Plus, helping British bakeries deal with leftover dough.
For example, if a customer cancels an order or if a mistake is made on an order, there's nothing we can do once the dough is mixed to take that back again.
Solution? Turn it into beer. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's good to have you with us today, and a happy May Day to you. For the past few weeks, we've been following the story of nearly 200 people from Central America traveling through Mexico. Some have called it a caravan of migrants, and this one's gotten a lot of media attention, not to mention several tweets about it from President Trump. Over the weekend, the caravan made it to Tijuana, Mexico. Dozens of these migrants planned to seek asylum in the U.S., and they've been camping overnight outside the San Ysidro port of entry. Some have been detained. A number of them are reportedly being processed by U.S. border officials. We wanted to know what processing actually means in cases where people seek asylum here. So we reached out to Mana Yagani. She's an immigration lawyer in Houston. Walk us through exactly what happens when someone seeking asylum goes up to a U.S. Customs and Border Patrol official and says, "I fear danger and persecution in my own country."
So the first thing that happens is the person surrenders themselves to Border Patrol, and then they are taken into custody. So the refugee or the migrant, they understand that they're not going to be welcomed with a bouquet of flowers. They will go into custody, which is a fancy way of saying immigration jail. But because they fear for their life and they are seeking refuge in the United States, they are accepting that and willing to go through that process. So when the person surrenders themselves, CBP, Customs and Border Protection, will take their fingerprints. They take a mugshot of them. They retrieve their identifications, their birth certificate, their passports. Then at that point, they do a short question and answer with them. If the person under oath testifies that they have fear of persecution and they cannot return to their home country, under international law and U.S. law, we have a duty to process them for asylum. At that point, their case will be referred to the regional asylum office, where an officer will conduct something called a credible fear interview.
Once you arrive at the border and you are taken into custody, how long does it take to get that fear interview?
Depends on how many people are booked in custody. Generally, it can take anywhere from a week to several months.
So what is that credible fear interview process like? And is that the point that you as an attorney would get involved?
In immigration proceedings, because it's civil proceedings, the government does not give court-appointed or free lawyers, so to speak. There are some organizations that do pro bono work, but generally the person is poor. They don't have the means to hire an attorney. The basis of the credible fear interview is to see if the person has fear based on five categories of asylum, which are their race, their religion, nationality, their political opinion, and membership in a particular social group. If they can establish fear based on one of these categories, they will be able to move on to the next process. However, if in their interview to the asylum officer, they say, "I'm here for economic reasons. I can't find a job. I need a better life." Generally, that is grounds for their credible fear to be denied. And the asylum officer will say, "You will be deported back to your home country."
What are the kind of questions being asked in the interview?
The interview is lengthy. The asylum officer will ask probably over 100 questions. They will ask the same question five different ways to make sure that the person being interviewed is not lying or fabricating a story. The type of questions they ask are based on the five categories. For example, political opinion. If someone is an activist in their home country or a journalist and they are writing articles against the government, that's grounds for asylum.
So we come to the end of this flowchart. What comes next, both for people who do qualify for asylum in the U.S. and people who don't qualify?
If the person does not qualify for asylum, they will be deported to their home country. If they are deported, there is a 5-year bar from them returning to the United States. If the person is found to have credible fear, their case will be referred to an immigration judge. When they are in front of an immigration judge, they must establish that they cannot return to their home country. And what that means is that evidence must be presented to the immigration judge. They have to have documentation, a police report to show that they tried everything in their home country to protect themselves, but their government is not willing to protect them. They must have letters to show that they did receive a threat. If the judge does grant them asylum, then after 1 year, they're eligible to apply to get a green card. However, keep in mind that gathering this evidence is very difficult because a lot of times people from Honduras and El Salvador, they're unable to go to a police station to make a report because the police and their government is corrupt. And a lot of the gang members who assassinate people are part of the police. And one of the patterns that we see in immigration court is that over 85% of asylum cases that are referred to an immigration judge are denied. It's a very difficult and complicated process. The way that the president and the attorney general have presented it, it just seems like these people are breaking our laws. But really, they are victims of both countries, the country which they left and the country they're trying to come and resettle in.
Mana Yagani, an immigration lawyer there in Houston, Texas. And now another immigrant story we've been following for a couple of years. It's about Hector Barajas. He's an Army veteran, got an honorable discharge back in 2001. Later, he got in trouble with the law. Hector was arrested after someone fired a gun from inside a car he was riding in. That led to a criminal conviction. And because Hector was not a U.S. citizen at the time, he was deported to his native Mexico. For the next decade and a half, Hector fought his deportation and that of many other veterans. I interviewed him 2 years ago in Tijuana, where he had created a shelter for deported vets known as the Bunker. At the time, he wasn't sure if his application for U.S. citizenship was ever going to go anywhere. Fast forward to last month when Hector was finally sworn in as an American citizen in San Diego. We reached Hector again, still in Tijuana, but via Skype this time, to ask him how he feels.
It feels good. It feels good that I can travel back and forth with my family and then not having that barrier that, well, there's a couple little things that I go through because it shows I was deported in the system, so they sent me to secondary. But
well, like a secondary check that you have to pass through to get through the border?
Yeah, but it's okay. If I have to wait in 30 minutes extra or whatever, I mean, it's worth the wait.
Yeah, relative freedom of movement for sure. This won't be news to me, but take us back. You were a U.S. Army paratrooper. When and why did you enlist?
I enlisted in 1995. I enlisted for various reasons, promises of citizenship, changed my environment, wanted to serve my country, and as corny as it sounds, I wanted to be a G.I. Joe. I actually enlisted for 4 and then re-enlisted for another 3. Mm. And eventually, I was chaptered out of the military with honorable discharge, but just ran into some problems and went in for a discharge of a firearm in 2001. And I thought I was going to be okay, that I was going to serve my time, but I got picked up by immigration and I was deported.
Yeah, so sentenced to 3 years in prison after that problem with the gun. That was after your second tour of duty in 2001. And then deported. Suddenly you were in Mexico, the country you'd left at the age of 7. How did you cope? Like, how old were you when you got deported?
Well, when I got deported, I was in my mid-20s, but I said, I'm not staying here. And I came back 6 months later, and I had to live the undocumented life as an adult for the first time for about 4 years. But, you know, I was always worried about getting picked up. And finally, one day, I had a minor fender bender, and then I was deported for the second time in 2010. And that's when I decided, you know what, I don't want to go back and, hide and I wanted to tell my story, and I decided to, and it just one thing led to another, and we started connecting with different people. I opened up the Bunker.
Yeah, let's tell us about the Bunker. This is the nickname for the Deported Veterans Support House. What were you trying to do for deported vets?
Sure. When it started, the support house, it was basically my apartment. I decided, we're going to publicized that we're going to take in deported veterans. And I started out of my apartment, but that's all it was. It was just a place for people to stay. So I ran into some issues there. But when I decided to do this the second time, I decided that we needed to have a mission, that we needed to have rules. Guys needed to do chores, and we worked on establishing the nonprofit, and we became a resource center. We've helped out men for their VA benefits, pension compensation, volunteer counselors. We do anything from funeral details to whatever the men come to our doorsteps for. We try to go out of our way above and beyond, but our main thing is housing and benefits at the moment. Right. That's what we're trying to focus on.
Yeah, and it's pretty impressive because, I mean, there are vets that go back to the Korean War that get your services. You said there were some issues as you were setting up the Deported Veteran Support House. What were those issues?
Well, you know, if you have a place where you don't really have any rules, and even when you have rules, you still run into problems because some people don't want to follow the rules. Like for the residents, no drinking. So those are the kind of things. And if you open the door to those kind of things, especially with some of our men that have issues with alcohol dependency, then you're opening up for relapsing.
Hmm. I'm curious to know, too, Hector, like getting your own 2 feet right in the middle of these concerns for deported vets. How did that help you?
What helped me with the Deported Veteran Support House is it gave me a sense of purpose and a responsibility. And that's what kept me focused and not fall into real bad depression, knowing that the next day I have to get up. And I, through my advocacy, I was able to get a Governor Jerry Brown. I started working with other people from the ACLU, and they decided to come up with asking for a pardon. For pardons for deported veterans, and it worked. I was able to get my. That was the biggest hurdle, is the criminal conviction for me.
Can you remind me briefly what happened in that firearm incident?
Sure. Basically, there was, you know, we were driving around and somebody fired a weapon, and even if I tell you the details, it's, you know, like irrelevant because I'm the one that pled guilty to it. So I just I've always told people I take responsibility for it. I went to prison for it and got deported. But I feel in general, you know, whether it's myself or any other deported veteran, that regardless of the conviction that they've either were pled guilty to or they were convicted of, that they shouldn't be deported. It's just morally wrong to deport veterans. We're not condoning criminal activity. If you commit a crime, you should definitely do the time. But deporting a veteran just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I know some politicians are pulling back and taking action. There's a California legislator setting up a legal aid fund for deported vets. And one member of Congress, Joaquin Castro from Texas, wants to prevent deportations of vets in the first place. What do you see as the most important thing for the government to do about this?
Well, legislation is very important. So I'm actually meeting with a member of Congress and also connecting with different people from the VA so that we can change certain VA policy also. So that's important. Let's say we can't go home. Let's make sure that some of these men and women get some of the benefits that they're not able to get because they're not in the United States. We do get some benefits, but not the full benefits. And that's what we're trying to change.
And do you think that's going to be kind of what you're going to be working on? That's what your work will be, is working on Veterans Affairs.
I decided actually. So I made a comment in the past that, you know, if I were to go home, I would volunteer for another year here at the support house. So I decided to stay here to ensure that our doors stay open and that I continue to do my advocacy, and also to make sure that we have enough funding for next year so I can pass on the baton to somebody else. And I'll still continue my work, but I need to go back and I want to catch up with my daughter. She's 12. She's going to turn 13. So,
and she's right in now, Tijuana, or she's in California?
No, she's in California. But, you know, like I told the guys, I could be picking up my daughter from school right now. And I'm here helping you guys out because I care. Just because I got my citizenship doesn't mean that's it. You know, see you guys. But after this year, I this is what I've been fighting for. And I want to make sure that, you know, if she's going to, you know, once she turns 18, she might end up in college. I'm going to be there for her as much as I can in the next couple of days.
Yeah, and at the end of the working day, you can cross the border and see her.
Yes, exactly.
Hector Barajas, the founding director of Deported Veteran Support House in Tijuana, Mexico. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you, Marco, and see you on the other side of the days.
Up next on the show, making beer from old bread. Carb lovers of all stripes rejoice. Just ahead on The World.
This podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to our podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics with far-reaching implications, from how venture capital is fueling innovation, to the global shift toward renewable energy, to the economic impacts of President Trump's legislative agenda, and more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to the world. A few years ago, I was on Cape Cod and came across a sea turtle that had washed up on the beach. The turtle couldn't swim because its flippers had gotten tangled up in some old nylon fish nets and a plastic six-pack holder. We cut the trash off and pushed the turtle back into the tide. No idea whether it survived, but it reminded me just how much a problem those six-pack holders can be for wildlife. Animals get caught in them. Some animals die from trying to eat them. Well, a couple of other guys had pretty much the same realization I did, but they actually decided to do something about it long term. They invented a six-pack holder that might actually help marine animals. They paired up with a brewery in Florida, made a prototype, and back in 2016, produced a flashy promotional video.
Saltwater Brewery presents Edible Six-Pack Rings. A six-pack ring that feeds animals instead of killing them. We developed a material made of barley and wheat remnants from the brewing process that replaces plastic and also is edible for sea animals.
But turning that bright idea into an actual product turned out it wasn't so easy.
Well, I can say it was much tougher than what we expected.
Jorge Reynoso is the CEO of E6PR. That's the company that finally did turn the prototype into a product, but only after about a year and a half of research. Reynoso says it took so long because it's hard to make a material that's tough enough to do its job, but can also break down if it ends up as litter.
One of the things that we really wanted our product to do is to work for the consumer that will put it in a cooler with ice, with water, take it to the beach, and have the product maintain the cans in its place. And then the challenge is for that six-pack holder to be able to biodegrade, be able to dissolve itself in time.
The company eventually landed on a holder that's made out of plant fibers like barley and wheat straw. It degrades in 3 to 12 months. And in the meantime, Reynoso says it won't hurt animals if they try to eat it. The holders hit the shelves in January, and today 3 craft breweries are using them. Reynoso says more are testing them out. E6PR ultimately decided not to market their material as edible so people wouldn't try to eat them. Next step for the company, come up with a recipe that uses grains left over from making beer.
What we plan to do on the next phase is start working with medium to large scale beer producers to test their different spent grains and see how they perform.
We wish them luck in that effort. Well, here's another story about beer and the environment. This one's also about grains and which ones are used to make beer in the first place. Let me back up just for a second. It turns out about 1/3 of the food that's produced around the world ends up going to waste. Yeah, 1/3. Growing and making that food emits more greenhouse gases than most countries do. So not only is food waste a problem for the world's hungry people, it's also a big contributor to climate change. But one British brewery is trying to tackle this food waste problem. The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler takes us to a London pub to tell us more.
It's a Wednesday night in central London, and the trendy Temple Brewhouse pub is packed with people out after work for beers and burgers. Crowded around a table in the corner is a group sipping intently from small tasting glasses.
I'm drinking the Toast Amber Ale. I have a half pint of the keg and a half pint of the cask version.
This is Michael Mulcahy, who says both versions taste sweet at the beginning.
And both have a long aftertaste that's a little bit more bitter and grainy than I would prefer. But I'll definitely drink them because I help make them.
Mulcahy helped brew this beer about a month ago, along with some of the other patrons here. They used an unusual ingredient, leftover bread. The beer was produced in a collaboration between the brew pub, a local bakery, and a brewery called Toast Ale.
Toast is an award-winning craft beer that's brewed with surplus fresh bread.
This is Toast's chief financial officer, Louisa Zion.
So in the UK, 44% of all bread is wasted. So we take surplus bread from bakeries and sandwich makers, and we replace a third of the barley that would otherwise have been used to brew, upcycling bread that would otherwise have been wasted.
That bread provides some of the sugars that turn into alcohol during brewing and cuts down on the amount of fresh barley needed. Toast launched 2 years ago and sells its commercial ales at grocery stores and restaurants around the UK. At the brewery in the north of England, they use the heels of bread loaves that are normally discarded by a company that makes sandwiches.
But we recognise that there are bakeries up and down the country who are left with surplus bread at the end of the day, and there are also over 2,000 breweries in the UK.
So Toast is playing matchmaker with these bakeries and breweries to organise small one-off brewing events like this one.
So it's a great way of using a local source of bread surplus, working with a local brewery, and also giving back to that community.
A small London bakery chain called The Flower Station donated a van full of bread for the beer that's on tap tonight. Tara Griffin says about 1-2% of the bread they bake ends up going to waste.
For example, if a customer cancels an order or if a mistake is made on an order, there's nothing we can do once the dough is mixed to take that back again.
A nonprofit picks up leftover bread at the chain's two retail locations, but the company still hasn't found anyone interested in the big batches of mistakes from their wholesale bakery.
Because bread has a short shelf life, it's not the easiest product to move on to someone else.
So the Flower Station is happy to have Toast make use of as much of their bread as they can. Back at the pub in the in-house brewery's tiny fermenting room, head brewer Vanessa de Blas says replacing some of the barley with bread doesn't change the brewing process too much. Except when you mix the water, barley, and bread to make what's called the mash, you have to stir a lot more.
The most difficult part of brewing with bread is that it floats. It floats on top and it makes it really difficult. It's really hard work. So instead of mashing in about half an hour, it takes you an hour and a half to mash, and it's quite a lot of effort. Yeah.
Beer maker and taster Michael Mulcahy helped stir that mash with a red plastic shovel. I caught up with him again on the sidewalk outside of the noisy bar.
It's backbreaking. I couldn't do it on a daily basis.
But it was worth it to Mulcahy. He's in the food industry, and he likes that this beer is prompting conversations about food waste among people who don't know much about the topic.
It's the guys at the bar drinking beer. It's football and baseball, and that relates to food waste and the environment in a different way. It takes it away from just being, you know, a hippie environmentalist thing. It's the pub.
Toast says mainstreaming the fight against food waste is their main mission. They've published their beer recipe online for homebrewers to try, and they've expanded to South Africa, Brazil, Iceland, and New York City. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, London.
Be sure to tune into The World tomorrow. We'll have a story about Khalida Popal. She's from Afghanistan, and she learned at a young age that sports were off limits for girls even after Taliban rule. It happened when she and a group of girls were harassed for playing soccer, or football, as she calls it.
And then we got attacked, and I took that as a mission for my life. And I said, I will get that ball back, and I will prove that women can play football too.
Popal went on to lead the Afghan women's national team, and now she's coaching a group of homeless girls from Mexico who will be competing soon in something called the Street Children's World Cup.
When I was in Mexico, I felt we are sisters.
Khalida Popal, right here on the show tomorrow.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's a fact of life. Attorneys are expensive. You're likely to pay around $300 an hour. That's just one reason why smart business owners turn to LegalZoom. In fact, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out with things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews. LegalZoom created their business legal plan to help you get legal advice for your business from vetted, independent attorneys and tax professionals available in every state. You also receive access to NDAs, lease agreements, and more. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Instead, you just pay one low upfront price. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan today and get special savings when you visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the crazy but true story of the Sudanese beach resort run by Israeli spies.
By day, they ran the resort. They were scuba diver instructors. They were windsurfing instructors. Incidentally, they brought windsurfing to Sudan.
And by night? Well, stick around and find out. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's hard to say what President Trump will do with the Iran nuclear deal. If he does back out of it, that could set in motion a scenario that both Tehran and Washington say they'd like to avoid.
It seems that both sides are longing for war. I don't understand why, but the Iranian government is threatening Israel. Israel is threatening Iran, and it seems that they are like two kids just want to start a fire.
That's Roya, a translator based in Tehran. She asked that we use only her first name. We'll also hear in a moment from a woman in Israel. And yes, these are only two people, two opinions, and not representatives of their entire countries. But they show us that the story about the Iran nuclear deal is not black or white. As Roya told me, Iranians didn't get the economic benefits they were hoping for from the deal.
The Iranian people have not benefited from the deal the way they expected. And we know that it's not all the fault of the other side. I mean, the Iranian government can be also blamed for that.
I want to ask you what you meant when you said the Iranian government must share some of the blame if things aren't working with the deal.
I personally expected the government to be wiser, to have more interaction with the West, stop threatening Israel and interfering in Syria and things like that. So I was hoping for more cooperation with the European countries and economically having interaction with the European countries and even the U.S., but it didn't happen. Nothing has changed.
So yesterday, as you know, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a presentation about Iran's nuclear program, that they had one, were planning to make weapons. Some have referred to it as a TED Talk. Did his presentation make any impact in Tehran?
Not really, because people know that he was repeating, you know, some of the old cases. They know that he doesn't want to do anything to make peace in the region. So he just repeated the same old stories. The Iranians don't want a war. They've been through a war and we know how difficult it is. If he really wants to have a peaceful region, he shouldn't say these things because he is like a child just retaliating whatever the Iranian government says. And I just don't understand why President Trump should want to have a war in the region because it's not going to help anyone.
You're making an assumption that the breaking of the deal would lead to war.
It depends on President Trump, and he's not very predictable. And also, the Iranian government is not very, you know, aggressive towards what Mr. Netanyahu says, what Mr. Trump says. This side is calm and is trying just to keep calm. But the other side is just threatening, and I don't see the point. And I wonder if the American people would go for another war that the U.S. is involved.
When we're talking about the nuclear deal, what is the West missing when we try to understand Iran's position?
The West is still trying to be dictating what Iran should do. It's like that they want certain things to be done by Iran. And of course, Iran does not do those things. So it's like that they have forgotten that they should get, you know, Iran involved. I think they didn't want to. When both sides have got their interests involved, then it will be difficult for both sides to break the deal. The Iranian government, I think it's not good for them to break the deal, and they will not. But if it happens, if the other side does that, then they will have the excuse for doing crazy things.
Roya is a translator. She lives in Tehran. Thanks for joining us, as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Adele Raymer lives just 1,000 miles from Roya, but they could be worlds apart. Adele lives on a kibbutz in southern Israel, not far from the border with the Gaza Strip. She's an English teacher. Adele, first of all, what do you and your friends make of this apparent action by Mossad to obtain these documents from Tehran in January?
Well, you know, I'm listening to the news and I'm listening to all the descriptions and everything. Like, you can't get this exciting in movies. It's pretty amazing. The fact that they got in, got the information out, got out, nobody got hurt. Pretty impressive.
So a successful scheme. What is your take, though, on the announcement from Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday that Iran lied about its nuclear program?
Well, is anybody surprised? Look, Prime Minister Netanyahu did the Bibi show. So it was like a lot of grandstanding, but he wanted to get the world's attention, and hey, he got it. I mean, I thought it was kind of embarrassing, but he got the world's attention.
How concerned are you that all of this talk about the Iran deal, backing out of it, could lead to another war?
I'm sort of optimistic that things will work out before it gets to that. I can't see, I hope, the world isn't going towards another world war, which is what it would be. But sometimes you have to carry that big stick, I guess. I'm much more worried about what's going on right over the border for me than this news, really.
You're talking about what's happening in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, which is much more real and present danger for me personally.
I gather some Israelis like you are also taking a fairly fatalistic approach to this, even lighthearted, like making jokes about it. Is that true?
There was this WhatsApp message that was going around yesterday saying that, it looked real. I'm just so used to hoaxes on the internet that I really didn't pay much attention to it. But saying that war is going to break out within 24 hours and... I mean, I don't know anybody who took it seriously, but I heard that some people did. And there's all sorts of macabre jokes about, I'm flying abroad tomorrow and my friend is also. And she said, I hope we have a country to come back to. People are sort of, trying to deal with it the way people do. But I really don't think it's going to lead to any serious outbreak of war.
Are you feeling that among a lot of people you speak with in Israel? I know you're just one person that we're speaking with.
I'm just one person, and I've been pretty busy these past 2 days, and it has not been the talk of the town where I've been. I can, just say that. I was at a teacher's conference today, and I was meeting with my carpenter, and I was yesterday doing this and that and the other thing, and nobody really talked about it.
What would you like to see the Iran-Israel relationship actually be?
I would love it to go back to what it was. It's nuts because we used to be allies.
Israel,
we used to have scientists.
And Iran, yeah.
Yeah. Open relations and scientists and intellectual interchanges. And like we used to have relations with them. And I don't understand why there can't be again. The fanatics in the world are just taking over, and I hate to say it, but it's like on all sides. My prime minister rules with fear. So does Trump. Everybody's ruling with fear, and wish we'd get some women in office, maybe. That would be different.
Teacher Adele Raymer in the Western Negev in Israel, thank you very much for your time today, and safe travels.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Israel is part of this next story, but honestly, if I came to you with this idea for a screenplay, you'd probably laugh. The story starts in the early 1980s. The Israelis decided they wanted to airlift thousands of Ethiopian Jews, refugees living in Sudan at the time, to Israel as part of a humanitarian effort. But the Sudanese government said no, so the Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, set up a fake vacation resort on the Red Sea, complete with brochures promising scuba diving, starlit desert nights, and the clearest water in the world, all in an effort to get the airlift operation done under the nose of the Sudanese government. My BBC colleague Rafi Berg has been reporting on this. So tell us how the Israelis dreamed up this idea in the first place of the Arus Resort on the Red Sea in Sudan.
It's real cloak and dagger stuff.
It all began with a single letter written by a Jewish Ethiopian refugee. Now, remember, I'm talking about Ethiopians here.
Right.
He had crossed the border into Sudan and sent a letter pleading for rescue to humanitarian agencies. The letter found its way up to the then Prime Minister, Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin then instructed Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, to find a way to bring the entire community of Ethiopian Jews to Israel. A couple of Mossad agents went to Sudan to check out the opportunities, and they stumbled across what was a derelict resort. It had shuttered for many years, but they thought that if we can get our hands on this, we could masquerade as holiday representatives and use it as a front to evacuate Ethiopian Jewish refugees from Sudan's Red Sea coast and off to Israel.
So before we get to the actual evacuation, tell me about this Ethiopian Jew who was in Sudan. How many others were there with him? Were they detained at all? And what was the attitude of Sudan's attitudes toward Jews living there in the early 80s? Because it's a mostly Muslim nation, right?
Correct. Well, his name was Fereda Akhlum. He was a pro-Zionist activist, and he was wanted in Ethiopia by the then Ethiopian authorities. So he made his escape to Sudan. There were thousands of Ethiopian Jews still in Ethiopia. And when Mossad made contact with Fereda Akhlum, he got a message back to the remaining thousands of his communities to say, listen, guys, we have got the best opportunity in over 2,000 years to get back to the land of Israel, because for many centuries, the Ethiopian Jews believed they were the only Jews in the world. They were so isolated. They practiced a biblical version of Judaism, which was different in many ways to the rest of Judaism as it's practiced by the rest of the Jewish community around the world.
So how many of these Ethiopian Jews actually ended up in this resort, Arus, or were they kind of out in the desert waiting for planes to pick them up?
They weren't taken to the resort. The resort was just a front for the Mossad operatives to entertain guests, to have a base. So by day, they ran the resort. They were scuba diver instructors. They were windsurfing instructors. Incidentally, they brought windsurfing to Sudan.
No
Sudan
kidding. Had never had
Sudan. One of the pieces of equipment, and remember, this is enemy Arab territory. So all the infrastructure in order to operate this isolated village, it was all smuggled in by night by covert flights from Israel. For instance, on the point of air conditioning units, they were manufactured in Israel. They were made by an Israeli company called Amcor. Well, what the agents did was just peel off the labels and they changed it to an invented company name called Luxair. So that's one of the ways they covered up their tracks.
Did any of the holidaymakers who went to Arus for, you know, these luxury vacations, did they suspect anything?
You would think so. There was one, possibly only one. You have to remember, there were hundreds of guests who stayed here. It ran for nearly or just over 4 years, and it was hugely successful. It even turned a profit. It's the only Mossad operation to have actually turned a profit. Just back to your question you asked, was any guest suspicious? There might have been one single individual who they guys I spoke to suspected he was from MI6, but once they were suspected to him, they just they gave him a wide berth and he left. So apart from that, there was no indication that any of the guests knew. It's an absolutely crazy idea, and it's all completely true.
So Rafa, you spoke with one of the Mossad agents involved in this scheme, Gad Shimron. How does he look back on it? Has Mossad ever done anything like this since?
He told me that he spent many years doing what he described as real James Bond stuff. Lots of covert operations, which he's not allowed to talk about. But he said, by far and away, this was the most satisfying operation of his life. He looks back at it incredibly fondly, not only because of the fabulous surroundings that he was living in for a few years, but because it was a purely humanitarian operation.
So how did the whole episode with the Ethiopian Jews end?
Well, what's fantastically exciting is how the village came to an end. The story was, with the operation rather, was totally top secret. So top secret that the Mossad guys couldn't even tell their own families what they were doing. However, it got leaked, and the head of Mossad instructed the agents to abandon the village. So on one night, the agents slipped out of the village, the entire Caucasian management. A Hercules aircraft was specially flown in from Israel, landed in the desert. The agents got on board, still travelling in the Sudanese jeeps that they left in, and they were flown back to Israel. Now, when the guests and the local staff woke up the next morning, there was nobody there.
That must have been quite a shock.
It must have been a big shock. The village shut down. It couldn't operate without them. I believe that there was an attempt several years afterwards to revive the village, but again, it failed because, if let's face it, if you haven't got the financial backing and the clout of an organization like Mossad behind you, you're going to find it very hard indeed.
My colleague at the BBC, Rafi Berg, telling us about a fake resort set up in Sudan by the Israeli Secret Service. Thanks very much, Rafi. Good to talk.
That's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Our next guest goes by the name El Dusty. And the first question I asked him was the obvious one. Where'd he get that nickname?
My parents always called me Dusty, and I went by Dusty my whole life and wrote it on all my school papers and all that stuff. But it's Horacio Ramon Oliveira.
And where did Dusty come from?
I have no idea. My dad's kind of a weirdo, so, you know.
Your dad gave you Dusty.
Yeah, yeah.
With that out of the way, I wanted to know more about his hometown of Corpus Christi, Texas. Corpus, as they call it, is a city that's a musical melting pot with two sounds that are somewhat complementary: cumbia from south of the border and from north of the border, the Tex-Mex style known as Tejano. In a moment, El Dusty will explain those rhythms, but first, here's what El Dusty sounds like. A lot of people in the United States, especially along the border, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, heard of Tejano, Norteño. Cumbia seems like it's been introduced more recently to people north of the border. Explain cumbia to us, because it is Mexican. It's also Colombian.
Mm-hmm. I think that cumbia is like the umbrella. You know, it's the rhythm of what it is. It's that it's the bigger genre. And then Tejano was like the cumbia that they were making in Texas. You know, like that's why it was called Tejano. You know what I mean? But it also, like, Tejano is a little bit soulful. It has a lot of, like, they were kind of like ripping off of like the American like funk bands and romantic like doo-wop stuff. So like the chords are like similar to like American stuff and like R&B, but it has this like cumbia rhythm and electronic drums and, you know, those toms that are super 808s and like, so, you know, it's we made our own style over there, and that's what Tejano was all about. But I think as Americans, you probably heard more the term Tejano than cumbia, just because, you know, cumbia is kind of like a Spanish word more, you know, and Tejano's like, you know, you see it on shirts all the time and stuff.
So so when you were growing up in Corpus Christi, Texas, was cumbia foreign to a lot of your friends but not foreign to you, or?
No, not at all. It's like loads of Hispanic people there. You know what I mean? So the culture is really like Mexican everywhere you see. There's Mexican restaurants everywhere. I mean, I
didn't know if everybody with kind of Latino roots was still listening to Norteño or Tejano, and you were kind of onto the cumbia.
No. I mean, you know, like Selena's from Corpus, you know, that's all cumbia. Like they really push that cumbia sound. Cumbia Kings, also from Corpus.
Right.
And so a lot of the bands, they kind of like sound like that, you know, like a lot of electronic drums and 808s and stuff like that, like I was saying.
That's the second time you mentioned 808. What's an 808?
808 is like the hip hop drum bass, you know, boom, you know what I'm saying? And so these guys started using it in their cumbia records, and it just took a whole new turn, you know what I mean? Using the drum sequencing and stuff like that.
So is Corpus Christi, Texas, did it start and does it remain today kind of the center of cumbia in the U.S.?
I mean, I wouldn't say that. You know what I mean? It's definitely a big part of it because Selena's, you know, the heartbeat, I feel like, of American cumbia, you know? And so, I mean, man, I hope just to, like, kind of pass that, you know, like, kind of keep it going, you know what I mean? And in my own ways, I'm not really making traditional cumbia music, but
I was
going to
say, your own way. What is your own way? Because it's cumbia, it's hip-hop, it's there's some rap going on.
I'm a Texas hip-hop guy, you know? I love rap music, and I was a DJ since I was 12 years old playing rap music, you know? And in Texas, it's all about DJ Screw, and there's a big Texas, and we're our own genre, you know what I mean? And so I wanted to be that guy. And just like, you know, taking elements from cumbia and stuff like that, I inherited this record collection from my mom that inherited from her cousin. And a lot of that stuff in there was like Spanish soul stuff. And it sounded a lot like Motown, but it had like congas and things like that. And
so really old school.
Old school. Yeah. And so that's what I was sampling. Instead of sampling like the Motown stuff, I was sampling the Spanish things, had elements of different things, and then cumbia is going on and around my neighborhood, so it's just like, let's just mash it all together, you
taking
know?
The old and making it new again.
Yeah.
So you've got a number of notable tracks, and they all have cumbia in it. Cumbia City, Cumbia Anthem, and now this new jam called simply La Cumbia with Bugat, Mexican-Canadian. This is like the NAFTA of hip-hop.
Yeah, man.
Does cumbia ever take a backseat to some other style?
Not really. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of like, my heartbeat is cumbia, and then everything around it, I make trap music, or I make hip hop, or house music. A lot of different genres on my album. You know what I mean? And Corpus Christi is like, right now we're like rebuilding the whole city. You know, it's under like a lot of construction and stuff like that. And on my album cover, I'm standing in front of my street downtown, and it's all like in shambles. You know, but when you go to that same street now, it's all fixed up and like nice. You know what I mean? And so that's kind of like my ode to the town, is like Cumbia City, we're Corpus, and like, you know, this is welcome. This is what we're doing over here, you know?
I assume that cumbia never really gets old for you.
Not really, man. I mean, it hasn't for hundreds of years, so let's keep it moving.
El Dusty, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, man. Peace.
El Dusty just wrapped a tour with Cut Chemist, but don't worry if you missed it. His album Cumbia City is out later this month, and he'll be back on the road again soon. We'll close with a track from it that features Cut Chemist in the Man and Bill Harris Studios, WGBH, here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.